Sensing this, it came up with an inimitable solution to a paralysis of its own making. It authorized the Kings River project for construction by both the Bureau and the Corps. Whichever could convince the appropriations committees to give it money first would end up building it. The fight now began to get serious. In its budget request for fiscal year 1947, the Truman administration said that the War Department's earlier requests to begin construction on both the Kings and the Kern River were to be considered officially eliminated. There were to be no further requests from the Corps of Engineers, pending a decision by the President as to the course to be followed on these works. In his personal testimony during the appropriations hearings, however, the Chief of Engineers calmly announced that "we are ready to make a definite recommendation to undertake the construction," a remark that could only be interpreted as smug defiance once again of his commander-in-chief. Had Roosevelt not died, the Corps might well have lost the battle. But Harry Truman lacked the romantic feeling about the reclamation program that Roosevelt had, and he was from a state where the Corps was generally loved. Ickes, the old curmudgeon, was gone too, replaced by the more conciliatory Cap Krug. In the end, the Corps simply played a waiting game, confident that the Grower's friends in Congress would extract money with which it could begin work on both the Kings and the Kern, which they soon did. Truman was so angry that he impounded the first funds, but he gradually lost interest in the whole affair. By 1948, he and Krug had given up. The Kings and the Kern Rivers belonged to the Corps. The Army engineers did accede to Truman's request that they collect a one-time user fee from the growers. The figure settled on was $14,250,000, which covered just a third of the $42,072,000 cost of Pine Flat Dam. Considering the tens of thousands of new acres that would be open to double crop production when the floodwaters were stored in the Pine Flat and Isabella reservoirs, the user fee was more tokenism than anything else. The covert liaison between the Corps of Engineers and the world's largest irrigation farmers was to live on. A few years later, the Corps added insult to injury by damming the Kaweah and the Tule Rivers, which by rights should have been reclamation rivers too. But as an example of government subsidizing the wrong people for the wrong reasons, nothing would quite equal its performance 35 years later in the Tulare Lake floods of 1983. During the El Niño winter of 1983, when the eastern Pacific's resident bulge of high pressure migrated to Australia and the storm door was left open for months, much of California got double or triple its normal precipitation. The previous year hadn't been much different. By the early spring of 1983, all four Corps of Engineers dams were dumping hundreds of thousands of acre-feet over their spillways as the largest snowpack in the annals of official California weather records melted. Because the farmlands in what used to be Tulare Lake were now protected by dikes, most of the water couldn't enter its old basin and had to go elsewhere. When the floodwaters began encroaching on nearby towns, the Corps of Engineers spent $2.7 million in emergency funds to erect levees around them. There was nothing inherently wrong with that, except that 80,000 acres of old lake bottom, land that could have absorbed the floods, remained dry. One need only have breached one of the levees that had since been built around the X Lake.
But the Tulare Lake Irrigation District,
dominated by Salyer and Boswell, wouldn't have that. So the growers convinced the Corps to spend taxpayers' money on levees in order that their land, the natural catch basin for the floods, could remain in subsidized production. However, El Niño was soon to prove too much even for the big growers and the Army engineers. By March of 1983, the flooding rivers were out of control, and one of the lake levees was breached, inundating 30,000 acres of farmland.
The Tulare Lake Irrigation District immediately applied to the Corps for a permit to pump out the water and send it over the Tulare Basin Divide into the San Joaquin River, which feeds San Francisco Bay.
There was nothing inherently wrong with that idea either. The bay and the delta normally can use all the fresh water they can get, except that at least one of the reservoirs upstream had been illegally planted with a species of fish called white bass,
which got flushed down by the floodwaters and were already flourishing in the reincarnated Tulare Lake.
White bass are a voracious, opportunistic, highly adaptable type of rough fish and love to eat young salmon and striped bass. Salmon and white bass have never managed to coexist anywhere. Unless a fish screen below the pumps could guarantee that 100% of the white bass would be removed before entering the San Joaquin, the Bay and Delta's two most valuable commercial and sports fish would be threatened with extinction. Just a handful of escaped white bass of opposite sexes could be enough to seal their doom. Even though no fish screen has ever operated 100% effectively, the Corps of Engineers, ignoring a cacophony of protests from sportsmen in several states, issued another emergency permit on Friday, October 7, 1983, to allow the pumping to begin. The growers hadn't even waited for the permit. The pumps were all in place and ready to operate, and television reporters who arrived to take a look at things were scared away by armed guards. The pumps howled to life minutes after the permit was issued. The California Department of Fish and Game had strung a gill net across the river below the fish screen, just in case. On Saturday morning, not 24 hours after the pumping began, the net yielded 4 white bass. The pumps were shut off, and Fish and Game, as if to underscore the catastrophic consequences of releasing white bass, poured 1,000 gallons of rotenone, a virulent pesticide, into 6 miles of river around the fish screens. Everything in that stretch of river, crappies, black bass, white bass, catfish, crayfish, ducks, died a ghastly death. A week later, Fish and Game performed a second mass poisoning. Then, satisfied that there was no danger to humans, it allowed the pumps to start up again. Every legal effort to stop them failed. Virtually all of the water was pumped out of the lake. And although there is no evidence yet that white bass got into the San Joaquin River and migrated down to the Delta and Bay, they could just as well be there. No one knows. If they are, and some sportsmen think it is inevitable that white bass will reach the Delta, then the last remnant of Central California's once prolific salmon fishery may soon be a thing of the past. It would have been one thing, this whole game of Russian roulette with the most important anadromous fishery in the state,
if the drowned lands in Tulare Lake were pumped out so they could grow valuable food.
Most of them, however, have been planted in cotton for years. And as the lake was being pumped out, they were not even growing cotton.
In March of 1983, just 4 days after the levee was breached and the floodwaters began to fill Tulare Lake,
several of the big corporate farmers applied to the Department of Agriculture for enlistment in the Payment in Kind, PIC, program, which had recently been created to relieve the nation's chronic problem of surplus crop production. Thanks to PIC, they would receive free grain from bulging silos in exchange for not planting crops. The Boswell Company alone got $3.7 million worth of wheat in exchange for keeping 14,000 acres idle. Boswell has consistently received more money from agricultural price support programs than any other farmer in the entire nation. No one knows how much the other farmers got, but most of the 80,000 acres of the old lake bed were registered in PIC, even as they were underwater. In his personal epitaph on the Kings and Kern saga, written in 1951, Harold Ickes lambasted the Corps as spoilsmen in spirit, working hand in glove with land monopolies. He called it a willful and expensive self-serving clique in contempt of the public welfare, which had the distinction of having wantonly wasted money on worthless projects to a degree surpassing any federal agency in the history of this country. No more lawless or irresponsible group than the Corps of Army Engineers, Ickes concluded, has ever attempted to operate in the United States either outside of or within the law. It is truly beyond imagination. The Corps' success in bouncing the Bureau of Reclamation off a project it had already been authorized to build, and 3 other projects where it should have been the one to build, had the effect Ickes foresaw. An effort was immediately launched by the state's growers to repeal all the constraining features of the Reclamation Act, the acreage limitation, the prohibition on leasing, the requirement that farmers must live within 50 miles of their land, as it applied to the Central Valley Project. Naturally, all the subsidies were to be retained. Even though the campaign failed, the Corps' record in California made the irrigation lobby throughout the entire West sit up and take notice. The Bureau of Reclamation was a good thing, but the Corps of Engineers, was a dream come true. At the same time the Corps and the Bureau of Reclamation were fighting over the rivers of the southern Sierra Nevada, they were engaged in a battle of more epic proportions over the Missouri River. The historical significance of that battle would be greater, too. Not only because the Missouri is a much bigger and more important river than the Kings or the Kern, but because, in defiance of common sense, economics, and even simple hydrology, the Missouri was an instance where both agencies managed to win. The Missouri River is, after the Columbia, the biggest river in the American West, though it takes it a long time to grow to size. The Columbia, rising prodigiously out of the rainforests of the Purcell Mountains in Canada, is like a Clydesdale horse, big and powerful at birth. The Missouri, still small after going a distance in which the Columbia becomes huge, is a scavenger of a river, struggling to attain size. It isn't until the North Dakota border, nearly 1,000 miles from its source, where the Yellowstone River adds a surge out of the Absaroka and Bighorn Mountains, that the Missouri begins to look impressive.
The river turns south, capturing the Platte and the Niobrara and the Kansas and the James, and then east again.
By the time it has gone 2,500 miles and joined the Mississippi, it is the 12th longest river in the world. However, because of the aridity of the basin it drains, the Missouri is only the 7th-ranking river in the country in terms of annual flow. Meager for its huge watershed and length, the Virgin Missouri also flowed erratic in the extreme. At Herman, Missouri, the discharge to the Mississippi has been measured as low as 4,200 cubic feet per second, and, in June of 1944, as high as 892,000 cubic feet per second, enough water in a day to satisfy New York City for a year. Its course was as unpredictable as its volume. Flowing across the glacial outwash of the plains, the Missouri is unconfined by a true canyon. It is held in check, more or less, by low bluffs as far apart as 10 miles. Even these bluffs, in the river's days of freedom, existed pretty much at the Missouri's whim. Within its wide and crumbly confinement, the Virgin Missouri writhed like a captive snake. Seemingly permanent islands and bottomlands covered by meadows and trees would seduce farmers down to the river. Then they would disappear, never to return, when the river made a lateral migration of a half mile in a single day. Boats often marooned on what had been the main channel the day before. Whole neighborhoods on the river bluff sometimes dropped in when the Missouri chewed its banks. Until 1940, when the Corps of Engineers finished Fort Peck Dam and created, for reasons that were and still are less than obvious, a 140-mile-long flood-control reservoir in the arid heart of Montana, the Missouri River was almost completely uncontrolled. There were two reasons for this. One was that the river didn't show promise of carrying much barge traffic, at least compared to other big rivers like the Mississippi and the Illinois, so the Corps of Engineers didn't have a good reason to improve it for navigation. Even if it had wanted to, the task of making such an erratic, muddy, unconfined river suitable for navigation was overwhelming. The Missouri habitually flooded Kansas City and other towns along its course, but until a major federal flood control act was passed in 1937, and until the Corps abandoned the doctrine, which it had held to with Ptolemaic rigidity, that reservoirs don't control floods, the Army engineers had little interest in doing much about it. The Bureau hadn't built much in the upper Missouri basin either, for the same reason that it hadn't built much along the upper Colorado and its tributaries. Irrigation farming in cold, high-altitude terrain was usually a losing proposition. It had investigated the basin thoroughly, and by 1907 it had 9 projects underway there, mainly for political reasons. The Missouri Basin states contributed a lot of money to the reclamation fund. But of the 9 projects, not a single one was going to pay for itself within the 40-year term required by the amended Reclamation Act. The 9 projects together owe the Treasury and the Reclamation Fund $55,755,000, but had repaid only $17,518,000, even though they were exempted from paying interest. At the rate that revenues, which depended more than anything else on the irrigator's meager ability to pay, were dribbling in, the projects wouldn't be repaid within 200 years, if ever. The only way to steer reclamation away from utter financial disaster in the Missouri Basin was to subsidize it with hydropower revenues. Hydroelectric output, being a function of two variables, volume of water and height of drop, it made good sense, from the Bureau's point of view, to build high dams along the upper tributaries to generate as much power as possible. The stored water could then be used to irrigate adjacent agricultural land, and hydropower revenues would cover the inevitable losses. Glenn Sloan, an assistant engineer in the Billings office, had begun to draw the outlines of such a basin-wide project in the late 1930s, and was reasonably close to finishing his report in 1943, when the Missouri decided to go on a rampage. It produced three big floods in March, May, and June, and during the last one, Omaha and Kansas City were navigable by boat. The Corps' regional office happened to be in Omaha, and its petulant director, Lewis Pick, who would later become the chief of engineers, was nearly chased by the river to higher ground. To a military man like Pick, it was an unforgivable insult. "I want control of the Missouri River," he is said to have barked at his subordinates. Before the end of the year, Pick had dispatched to Washington a 12-page report on harnessing the Missouri, which was to become known as the Pick Plan. The trouble with the Pick Plan and the Sloan Plan, which was frantically completed after the Bureau learned about the Pick Plan, was that you could logically build one or the other, but not both. The Corps wanted to build a few dams on upriver tributaries, although in locating them, it paid no attention at all to irrigation. It also wanted to erect 1,500 miles of new levees. All of that was dwarfed, however, by what the Corps planned to do to the river between Fort Peck Reservoir and Yankton, South Dakota. The plan called for five dams and reservoirs, all of them of monstrous size. Garrison Dam, in western North Dakota, was the largest, and would, as the Corps took pains to point out, contain 25 times as much material as the Great Pyramid of Cheops. 2.5 miles long, 210 feet high, the dam would be the second biggest structure on Earth. Fort Peck Dam was larger. The Washington Monument would stick out of it like a spike in a railroad tie. The other dams, Owyhee, Gavin's Point, Big Bend, Fort Randall, would be smaller, but large enough to dwarf almost anything else around. 800 miles of the Missouri would be transformed into a chain of huge, turbid reservoirs. The six mainstem dams would back up almost 90 million acre-feet of water, sufficient to turn Pennsylvania into a shallow lake. The whole scheme, if one believed the Corps' figures, which have always been notoriously low, would cost $660 million in 1944 dollars. There was almost nothing about the Corps' plan that the Bureau liked. The dams were all too low or poorly situated to draw the potential power out of the river. The Corps usually installed about as much public power as it felt the private power companies would tolerate, and it was no surprise to anyone that the Western Power Company became a champion of the Pick Plan, not the Sloan Plan. The storage was, with a few exceptions, far downriver from the lands the Bureau wanted to irrigate, and a lot of it was in the middle of unirrigable wastelands, which made the Bureau furious. The Missouri's potential as a navigable waterway, that was one of the main justifications of the Pick Plan, was, as far as the Bureau was concerned, shamelessly overstated. To spend more than $500 million on a river channel that would never carry more than a few hundred barges a year was a criminal waste of scarce money and water. It was wasteful in other ways as well. One of the reservoirs, Garrison, would drown the best winter cattle range in North Dakota. Although the Bureau had flooded its share of productive river bottomlands, this was an instance where it was troubled by the idea. As for flood control, Glenn Sloan, who understood the hydrodynamics of the Missouri River as well as anyone alive, said in congressional testimony that the 1943 flood could have been regulated to a safe capacity at Sioux City, Omaha, and Kansas City with only 2 million acre-feet in storage. But the Corps was talking about creating 60 million acre-feet of new reservoir storage. The Corps of Engineers' obsession with humbling the wild Missouri River seemed to derive mainly from the fact that Colonel Pick was mad at it. Although, needless to say, in the wake of the war, his agency, its staff swollen by the thousands, was eager for new work. According to Henry Hart, a journalist and historian who covered the Pick-Sloan controversy in the 1940s and later wrote a book about the Missouri, the Corps relied for justification entirely on the public sense of shock at the disruption caused by floods. Nonetheless, the Pick plan went through the House Rivers and Harbors Committee without a hitch and passed the full House in the spring of 1944, while still under consideration in the Senate. It seemed only a matter of weeks before it became law. The Bureau of Reclamation, meanwhile, felt so threatened by the Pick plan that it had quickly produced a plan of its own that was equally ambitious and only slightly more susceptible to logic. Reconnaissance studies of reservoir and irrigation sites were conducted with such haste that even within the Bureau they were referred to as windshield reconnaissance, an allusion to $30 million reservoirs being plotted from behind the windshields of moving cars. The Bureau spewed out project recommendations like popcorn. The final Sloan plan was a catch basin of 90 dams and several hundred individual irrigation projects. Among other things, it called for 15 reservoirs on three meager tributaries in the Dakotas. The Sloan plan, however, soon acquired some powerful supporters, too. By the end of 1943, the Congress had two irreconcilable plans before it. The lobbies behind them were about equally matched. Under the circumstances, there was only one thing to do: adopt them both. The impetus came from FDR himself, though the result was not exactly what he intended. With the Bureau and the Corps stalemated, Roosevelt decided to break the impasse by sending Congress a strongly worded letter saying that the solution to developing the Missouri Basin was to create a regional authority similar to the Tennessee Valley Authority and take development out of both agencies' hands. That was more than the Corps and the Bureau had bargained on. On October 15, 1944, Glenn Sloan and a representative of Colonel Pick, who had since gone off to build a Lido road in Burma, sat down in a meeting which is probably historic for what it accomplished in a given amount of time. On October 17th, 2 days later, they emerged to announce that the Pick plan and the Sloan plan had been reconciled. Had anyone taken a closer look, hardly anyone did, he would have seen that the reconciliation amounted to the adoption, virtually intact, of both agencies' plans. With the single exception of a dam at Oak Creek, South Dakota, originally proposed by the Corps of Engineers, the Pick-Sloan Compromise included every dam and project in the original and separate plans, plus some additions which the agencies had somehow managed to overlook. Critics such as James Patton, the president of the National Farmers Union, called it a shameless shotgun wedding and calculated that instead of saving the taxpayers' money, it would cost them at least $250 million in redundant features. Henry Hart acidly observed that reconciliation meant chiefly that each agency became reconciled to the works of the other. The most significant aspect of the reconciliation was that the two agencies had agreed to spend $1.9 billion of the taxpayers' money, an estimate which would, as usual, turn out to be much too low, on a whole whose parts, according to their earlier testimony, would cancel out each other's usefulness. The second most significant aspect was that the Bureau agreed to let the Corps go ahead and build its huge mainstem reservoirs first. "The Corps got the here and now," says David Wyman, a lobbyist who would later be hired to fight several of the Bureau's projects by the same farmers who were supposed to benefit from their existence. "The Bureau got the then and there." One of the least known consequences of water development in America is its impact on the Indians who hadn't already succumbed to the U.S. cavalry, smallpox, and social rot. Although many of the tribes had been sequestered on reservations that were far from the river bottoms where they used to live, some tribes had been granted good river bottom reservation land. either because the lands were prone to flooding or because the government was occasionally in a generous mood. The three tribes whom Lewis and Clark encountered along the Missouri River in North Dakota were the Mandan, the Hidatsa, and the Arikara. Perhaps because they were generally peaceful and had helped the explorers, Lewis and Clark spent their first winter with the Mandan, and their adopted Shoshone Mandan interpreter, Sacagawea, probably saved their lives. The associated three tribes were later rewarded with some of the better reservation land in the West, miles of fertile bottoms along the Serpentine Missouri, which they used mainly for raising cattle. These were the same lands that the Bureau of Reclamation considered the best winter cattle range in the state, and which it said ought never to be drowned by a reservoir. Under the Corps of Engineers plan, however, the three tribes' reservation would sit directly under the reservoir behind Garrison Dam. The Corps had, of course, taken extraordinary care not to inundate any of the white towns that were situated along the river. The reservoir behind Owyhee Dam, which would be more than 150 miles long, would stop just shy of Bismarck, North Dakota. Pierre, the capital of South Dakota, would sit safely inside a small reservoir-free zone between the tail end of Lake Francis Case and the upper end of Lake Owyhee. Were it not for the town, the two reservoirs would have virtually touched, nose to tail. Chamberlain, South Dakota, nestled between the reservoirs formed by Big Bend and Fort Randall dams, was similarly spared. The height of Garrison Dam was reduced by 20 feet so that the surface level of the reservoir would be 1,830 feet above sea level, not 1,850 feet as originally planned. It was a loss of several million acre-feet of storage exclusively for the benefit of Williston, North Dakota, a small part of which could have been subject to inundation during wet years. For the sake of the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, where the Mandan and the Arikara and the Hidatsa lived, no such intricate gerrymandering of reservoir outlines was even tried. Garrison Dam, which the Corps justified largely because of its flood control benefits downstream, was going to cause horrific local flood damage the moment its reservoir began to fill. Virtually every productive acre of bottomland the tribes owned would go under. Colonel Lewis Pick, the architect of the tribe's inundation, was the embodiment of a no-nonsense military man. Pick liked to punctuate his conversations with Cagney-style "See? Seas?" These were not questions, they were commands. When first assigned to the Missouri River Division during the early part of the Second World War, he ordered all of his staff to work a series of continuous 7-day weeks. On the first Sunday after the order was given, Pick spied on all his top officers and summarily dismissed those who were not at their desks. Later, when he was in Burma, he fired a whole team of surveyors for laying out a technically perfect road, which, in his opinion, would take too long to build. Instead, he designed a treacherous road that could be finished slightly sooner. Since what Pick proposed to do to the Indians was the most calamitous thing that had happened to them in their history, he might have had the good grace to leave the proceedings through which the tribe would be compensated to someone else. But Pick was a take-charge type. He not only insisted on participating, he insisted on running them himself. Initially, the three tribes pleaded with the government not to build Garrison Dam at all. "All of the bottomlands and all of the benchlands on this reservation will be flooded," wrote the business council of the three tribes in an anguished resolution condemning the plan. "Most of it will be underwater to a depth of 100 feet or more. The homes and lands of 349 families, comprising 1,544 individuals, will be covered with deep water. The lands which will be flooded are practically all the lands which are of any use or value to produce feed for stock or winter shelter. We are stockmen, and our living depends on our production of cattle. All of our people have lived where we now are for more than 100 years. Our people have lived on and cultivated the bottomlands along the Missouri River for many hundreds of years. We were here before the first white men stepped foot on this land. We have always kept the peace. We have kept our side of all treaties. We have been and now are as nearly self-supporting as the average white community. We recognize the value to our white neighbors and to the people downstream of the plan to control the river and to make use of the great surplus of floodwaters. But we cannot agree that we should be destroyed, drowned out, removed, and divided for the public benefit while all other white communities are protected and safeguarded by the same river development plan which now threatens us with destruction. However, when the Interior Department, the parent agency of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, threw itself behind the plan, the three tribes saw the futility of abject resistance. What they asked for as compensation, considering the agony they were about to be put through, was pitiful enough. First, they wanted at least an equivalent amount of compensatory land. Since it would inevitably be poorer land, they also wanted 20,000 kilowatt-hours per year of electricity, mainly to run the pumps they would need to bring water, once freely available from the river, up from depths of 300 feet or more on the arid plains. They asked for permission to graze and water their cattle along the margins of the reservoir, and for first rights to the timber which the reservoir would flood. They wanted a bridge built across a narrow reach of the reservoir so their people could maintain contact with one another. The reservoir would effectively split the reservation in half. Otherwise, they would have to spend hours driving around its endless shore, or brave violent winds and waves trying to cross its surface by boat. One small faction of the three tribes, led by a flamboyant young radical named Crow Flies High, remained opposed to any compromise at all. As negotiations were already underway between the Interior Department, the Corps, and the Tribal Business Council, a delegation from the dissident faction burst into the room in ceremonial dress and began disrupting the proceedings. The leader of the group, who was probably Crow Flies High, went up to Colonel Pick and made an obscene gesture. Pick turned the color of uncooked liver. It was an insult, he said lividly, that he would remember as long as he lived. On the basis of that petty insult, Pick stormed out of the negotiations, never to return. As far as he was concerned, all of the points of agreement that had already been reached were null and void. When Arthur Morgan, the first director of the Tennessee Valley Authority, and the one person who kept the memories of the Indians' tragedy alive, visited the three tribes sometime later, however, he discovered a different sentiment as to why Pick had walked out. There was, he wrote, a nearly unanimous opinion that the Corps welcomed the attack of the Crow Flies High group because it provided a semblance of justification for ignoring the clear terms of the law. Before the negotiations were interrupted, the Corps had offered the Indians some scattered property on the Missouri benchlands to replace the bottomlands they would lose. "I want to show you where we are going to place you people," a local Congregationalist minister quoted Pick as saying. Under the law, all compensatory lands were to be comparable in quality and sufficient in area to compensate the said tribes for the land on the Fort Berthold Reservation. It was up to the Secretary of the Interior, Cap Krug, to decide whether the criteria had been met. As Krug well knew, there was no land in North Dakota that could adequately compensate the tribes for prime winter cattle range in a river valley. He had decided, therefore, to accede to the Indians' other demands for water, at-cost hydroelectric power, and first timber and mineral rights. Since even this appeared to be too little, he also agreed to pay them $5,105,625 for the 155,000 acres they would lose. It was only $33 an acre, but it was better than nothing. Colonel Pick, however, was still smoldering over the indignity he had suffered, and he had his good friends in Congress. A few months after Krug announced that he was prepared to meet most or all of the Indians' terms, the disposition of their case was removed by Congress from Interior's hands and given to the Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs. The committee soon tore up Interior's version of the bill and wrote its own version exactly along the lines suggested by Pick. The Fort Berthold tribes would not even be permitted to fish in the reservoir. Their cattle would not be allowed to drink from it or graze by it. The right to purchase hydroelectricity at cost was abrogated. The tribes were forbidden to use any compensatory money they received to hire attorneys. They were not even allowed to cut the trees that would be drowned by the reservoir, except in one case, and there, according to the new terms, they were not permitted to haul them away. On May 20, 1948, Secretary Krug ceremoniously signed the bill disposing of the Fort Berthold Manor in his office in Washington. Despite some intervention by the Interior Department, most of the Corps' vengeful provisions were still intact. Standing behind Krug, alongside a slouching Mike Strauss of the Bureau of Reclamation and a scowling General Pick, was handsome George Gillette, the leader of the Tribal Business Council, in a pinstripe suit. "The members of the Tribal Council signed this contract with heavy hearts," Gillette managed to say. "Right now, the future does not look good to us." Then, as Krug reached for a bundle of commemorative pens to sign the bill, and as the assembled politicians and bureaucrats looked on embarrassed or stony-faced, George Gillette cradled his face in one hand and began to cry. To eliminate any possibility that Congress or the President might succumb to a tender conscience and eliminate Garrison Dam from the Pick Sloan plan, the Corps had already begun work on it in 1945, 3 years before the agreement with the Indians was signed. In fact, it would spend $60 million on ambiguously authorized preliminary work on the dam between 1945 and 1948. A number of members of Congress protested that such work was, if not outright illegal, then certainly a moral wrong. But the one party that might have gone to court for ruling, the Fort Berthold tribes, had been forbidden to spend any of their compensatory money on attorneys. The Fort Berthold Indians have never recovered from the trauma they underwent. Their whole sense of cohesiveness was lost, and they adjusted badly to life on the arid plains and in the white towns. But no humiliation could have been greater than for them to see the signs that were erected around the reservoir as it slowly filled, submerging the dying cottonwoods and drowning the land they had occupied for at least 400 years. In what looked to the Indians like a stroke of malevolent inspiration, the Corps of Engineers had decided to call the giant, turbid pool of water Lake Sacagawea. As is the case with most schemes that involve a dazzling transmogrification of nature, this is a story without an end. And a later chapter will say something about the likely consequences of trapping most of the Missouri silt behind 6 great dams. For now, it is worth looking briefly at what the Pick Sloan plan has wrought. The Corps' 6 Missouri River reservoirs, which cost $1.2 billion to build even then, have undoubtedly lowered the flood crests all the way down to New Orleans, though they did not prevent a disastrous flood in the early 1970s, when the Mississippi widened by several miles and caused tens of millions of dollars in damage. Barge traffic hasn't come close to the Corps' projections. In 1984, traffic on the entire navigable stretch of the Missouri amounted to only 2.9 million tons, an infinitesimal percentage of the 590 million tons carried by the Mississippi system. The small port of Lorain, Ohio, handled nearly 5 times as much. The worst natural damage was the flooding of some of the best riparian waterfowl habitat in the world. A former director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, John Gottschalk, remembers walking along the undammed Middle Missouri for 5 miles and flushing countless flocks of pheasants and migrating ducks. Today, one would be lucky to see anything at all. The birds thrived in the spacious, secluded bottomlands and oxbow pools and marshes, and those are almost entirely gone. Had the Missouri been left to the Bureau of Reclamation exclusively, things wouldn't necessarily have turned out much better. However, because the projects would, for the most part, have been well upriver, the Fort Berthold Reservation wouldn't have been drowned. A lot of riparian waterfowl habitat in the heart of the Central Flyway wouldn't have been inundated, and the dams, being high rather than wide, would likely have produced a lot more hydroelectricity for their size. The irrigation projects the Bureau planned might have been losers in an economic sense, but the Missouri, if it had to be intensively developed, might have been more useful irrigating crops than providing free transit at enormous public expense for a handful of barges. The Bureau, of course, was not to be denied either, if it could help it. Ever since the 1950s, it has been trying, without too much success, to build the irrigation projects authorized by the Pick Sloan plan, the then and later dams over which the Corps' reservoirs took precedence. The O'Neill Project on the Niobrara River in Nebraska, the Narrows Dam on the South Platte in Colorado, the Garrison and Owyhee projects in the Dakotas, projects that have become some of the most controversial in the nation, were all authorized by that same misbegotten act. The Bureau, of course, knew well enough that few, if any, of those projects made economic sense, and at least one of its officials, in private, was willing to admit it. In 1955, future Commissioner Floyd Dominey, then chief of the Irrigation Division, received an angry letter from two old farmer friends from Nebraska, Claire and Donald Hanna. The Hannas were dryland farmers, and they were incensed that the Bureau's Ainsworth project, one of the Pick Sloan bunch, might literally force them into irrigation farming. "I am really not happy about the Ainsworth project," Dominey confessed in his letter of reply of April 15, 1955. "My views about the impropriety and damn foolishness involved in the construction of irrigation project in relatively good dry land areas at the present have been repeatedly expressed. As dear and honored friends, I am troubled as how to advise you," Dominey went on. "The local towns and businessmen wanted it, the Ainsworth project. They could see themselves growing fat on large-scale construction payrolls. They could see something to be gained by increasing the number of farm families in their service area. Like the usual selfish citizen, they were willing to accept this increase to their personal larder without thought as to the burden to be placed on the federal taxpayer." Predictably, Dominey managed to overcome such scruples after he was appointed commissioner. In the 1960s and 1970s, the Bureau launched a mighty effort to push forward the Garrison-Owyhee projects, enormous diversions from Lake Sacagawea and Owyhee Reservoir to compensate North and South Dakota, if not the dispossessed tribes, for the land drowned by the Corps. But the irrigation canals and local storage reservoirs would have consumed nearly as much productive farmland as the irrigation water would have created. In the case of the Garrison Diversion Project, 220,000 acres for canals and reservoirs versus 250,000 new acres irrigated. In addition, Garrison, in its original version, would have converted some 73,000 more acres of superb waterfowl habitat, prairie marshes and potholes used by hundreds of thousands of migrating ducks into farm fields. Not only that, but it could easily have introduced parasites and competitive trash fish from the Missouri into streams emptying into Lake Winnipeg and Manitoba, threatening very productive pike and lake trout fisheries. The Canadians, in fact, had been screaming objections into the deaf ear of the Bureau for years, and even sent a series of stern diplomatic protests to the State Department. In the late 1970s, the Owyhee Diversion Project, after reigning for years as the biggest political issue in South Dakota, was defeated by the very same farmers for whose alleged benefit it was to be built, and one of its principal champions, former Senator George McGovern, saw his political career buried with it. McGovern's surprising loss, according to local political insiders, had as much to do with his unwavering support for a suddenly unpopular Owyhee project as it did with a campaign mounted against him by the ultra-conservative right. Garrison, in 1985, was partly completed and still alive, and a bobtailed version of the project seems likely to be built, irrigating perhaps 130,000 acres, devoted mainly to surplus crops, at a cost of $1,650,000 per farm. Energy requirements for pumping, which totaled 288,000 kilowatts under the original plan, would also be reduced. But how the dams can pump water to 130,000 acres and sell power at market rates to subsidize the water costs is a question that no one, least of all the Bureau, can answer. As for the other dozens of projects assigned to the Bureau, few have been built, but the Corps, despite the antipathy of the local citizenry, has tried to steal away even these. On May 9, 1963, Dominey's regional chief in Billings, Bruce Johnson, reported that the Corps is not dismayed by the opposition to two newly proposed dams on the Missouri, Fort Benton and High Cow Creek, nor, Johnson said, would the highly preliminary stage of the basic investigations deter them. They will, I think, seek authority to build both dams. As a result, Johnson advocated that we grit our collective teeth and decide to use the reconnaissance data that we have so we can go to the Hill just as quickly as the Corps does and ask for authority to build without additional investigation. If such additional investigation, reconnaissance data are usually based on a mere desultory look, disclosed that either dam would be a waste of money, that was the taxpayer's problem. Even if Fort Benton and High Cow Creek dams have not yet been built. Between the money-losing irrigation ventures in the Mississippi Basin and the river's mediocre power potential, the Missouri Basin Fund appears to be in unhealthy financial shape. The problem is, no one knows exactly how bad things are. According to a Carter administration audit, Missouri Basin Power is already vastly oversubscribed, and the Corps and the Bureau, employing some complex economic chicanery even the auditors couldn't quite decipher, may be borrowing on anticipated revenues from as far away as the next century, just as New York did in the early 1970s, before some of its elected officials almost went to jail. Our conclusion is that the financial posture of Pick Sloan is at best based on an uncertainty, the auditors wrote. At worst, it is based on an unreality. The reconciliation of the Pick plan and the Sloan plan had taken a mere 2 days. The political fallout, the environmental damage, and the drain on the Treasury that have resulted seem likely to go on forever. It was back in California, meanwhile, that the bitterest rivalry and the most vicious infighting between the Bureau and the Corps continued to occur. Awkward, expensive, and redundant as it was, Congress had at least come up with some kind of division of responsibilities in the Missouri Basin. The same applied to the Columbia Basin. In California, however, the two giant bureaucracies were left pretty much to fight it out among themselves. Their rivalry was a wonderful opportunity for the state's irrigation lobby. The growers could sit back and smile coyly as they were madly pursued by rival suitors in hard hats. But it was an equally wonderful opportunity in the 1960s for Governor Pat Brown, under whose leadership the state was trying all by itself to complete the most expensive water project ever built. On Wednesday, January 27, 1965, a highly secret meeting was held in the office of California's Resources Secretary, Hugo Fisher. In attendance were most of the oligarchs of water development in California: Pat Brown's Water Resources Director, Bill Warren; Robert Pafford, the Bureau of Reclamation's Regional Director; Brigadier General Arthur Fry of the Corps of Engineers; Ralph Brody, the Chairman of the California Water Commission; State Senator James Coby, and Assemblyman Carly Porter, the chief author of the bill that authorized the state water project in 1959. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss the future of Marysville Dam. With all the Big Sierra rivers developed close to their limits, precious few good dam sites were left anywhere in the state except on the north coast. There were, however, still three rather marginal sites in the Sierra foothills which the Bureau wanted to develop in order to augment the water supply of the Central Valley project. One was New Maloney's on the Stanislaus River. Another was Auburn Dam on the American River. The third was Marysville Dam on the Yuba River. Of the three rivers, the Yuba at the time had the blackest reputation. It had devastated Yuba City and forced the evacuation of 20,000 people during an awesome flood in 1955. And just a few weeks earlier, it had flooded menacingly again during the Great Christmas Storm of 1964. The dam, therefore, was of interest not only to the Bureau but to the Corps of Engineers. No one, however, was more interested in it than the Governor of California and his Director of Water Resources, Bill Warren. Brown and Warren had an unenviable dilemma on their hands, even if they brought it on themselves. They had misrepresented, either unintentionally or by design, the cost of the state water project and were left without the funds to finish it. The state had signed binding contracts to deliver 4,230,000 acre-feet of water. The $1.75 billion bond issue that the voters had approved, however, would not even suffice to build Oroville Dam, San Luis Dam, and the 444-mile aqueduct down the San Joaquin Valley and over the mountains to Los Angeles. All of those works could deliver a safe yield of only 2.5 million acre-feet of water. Somehow, the state had to come up with nearly 2 million additional acre feet, quite an imposing agenda. The water was there, on any number of Northern California rivers. But since the voters had just shouldered the most expensive state bond in history, the money to develop it was emphatically not. Marysville Dam, therefore, was exactly the opportunity Brown and Warren were looking for, provided the state project could gain rights to some or all of the water and contribute little or nothing to the cost of the dam. No federal dam could be built without the consent of the governor of the state. The question, then, was which of the potential builders would give the state what it wanted, the Bureau or the Corps? The report on the meeting which Bob Pafford of the Bureau sent to his superior in Washington, Commissioner Floyd Dominey, began on a gloomy note. The state was very much inclined to let the Corps build Marysville, for obvious reasons. There would be no federal claim on the water in a purported flood control reservoir and no strings attached to its use, as there would be if the Bureau built the dam. Pafford, however, held out one hopeful prospect to Dominey. California might be willing to recommend changing their position from one of strong support for immediate construction and operation of the Marysville Reservoir by the Corps of Engineers, with the state taking the conservation water via Title III, to one of support for immediate authorization of Marysville for early construction by the Corps, but with a project to be integrated fully with the Central Valley Project.
The Title III of which Pafford spoke referred to a section of the Federal Water Supply Act of 1958, which allowed water from a federal dam to be sold to another political entity, such as a city or state, provided the water was used only for municipal or industrial purposes, that is, not for irrigation. The provision, in fact, owes its existence to the earlier battle on the Kings and the Kern Rivers. There was so much resentment over the fact that the state's biggest growers had gotten an enormous supply of water virtually free from the Corps that a number of congressmen vowed never to let it happen again, and the result was Title III. But Brown and Bill Warren's predicament was that the state water project was first and foremost an irrigation project. The specter of water famine in Southern California gave the project its moral justification, and Los Angeles offered the assessed property wealth needed to guarantee the bonds, but the first deliveries of water would go to the big corporate farmers in the San Joaquin Valley. Los Angeles wasn't scheduled to receive its full entitlement for many years, and in fact would take only a fraction of each year's entitlement all through the 1970s and early 1980s, permitting most of the water to be sold at bargain prices as surplus water to the same big growers in the San Joaquin Valley. Pafford told Dominey that he had cautioned Warren about the inherent legal risks in trying to use the water from a federally built reservoir to augment a state project whose main purpose, at least for now, was irrigation. I pointed out that authorization for the sale of water under Title III might severely limit the use of this water, since the Act referred to the use of water only for municipal and industrial purposes. In other words, if the Corps built the dam, the whole arrangement would be quite naked, the Kings and the Kern all over again, and probably enjoinable in a court of law. If the Bureau built the dam, on the other hand, the water, in theory, would have to go into the Central Valley Project, and the state water project's main beneficiaries, the big San Joaquin growers, could not touch a drop. There had to be a way out of the predicament, and Bill Warren was canny and cynical enough to come up with it. What if the Corps built the dam on the promise that the water would someday flow into the Central Valley Project? And what if, since there was still plenty of surplus water sloshing around in the CVP, the Bureau let the state water project borrow it for a while? What Warren wanted to do, Pafford confided to Dominey, and he apparently thought it wasn't a bad idea, was create exactly such an arrangement as a test of this act, by which he meant Title III of the Flood Control Act of 1958. If the Corps built the reservoir and the state took the water with no strings attached, they were risking a head-on collision with existing law. But promising the water to the Bureau, eventually, might provide a legal out. Congress should have no objection to California's borrowing it for 20 or 30 years. That would give the state time enough to climb out from under the staggering pile of debt that the construction of its huge water project had dumped on it,
and to build the necessary works to develop the full 4,230,000 acre-feet of water it was legally obligated to provide. If the Bureau acceded to Bill Warren's plan, it wouldn't get to do what it loved best, build a dam. But at least it would get something out of it instead of being boxed out entirely, as it was on the Kings and the Kern and the Kaweah and the Tule. That it was willing to let itself be so used is an indication of how desperate the Bureau had become since the Corps of Engineers began trying to muscle its way into its domain. If anything, Pafford ought to have been incensed by Warren's idea. After all, the Bureau, more than any other single entity, had made California into the wealthy and populous state it was. It built Hoover Dam for Los Angeles and the Imperial Valley, and Parker and Davis and Imperial Dams as well. It built the Central Valley Project to rescue the growers from economic suicide by groundwater overdraft. It was paying nearly half the cost of the world's fourth largest dam, San Luis, which would store water jointly for both the CVP and the state project. Without such assistance, the California project might have fallen on its face. And on top of this, the state's big farmers, when they began to receive cheap surplus water from the state project, would be in a position to engage in cutthroat competition with the Bureau's constituency, the smaller farmers. From the point of view of many small farmers, and this would be borne out later in actual fact, the expansion of the state water project was one of the worst things that could happen. Not only did outrage fail Bob Pafford, but he was willing to go the Corps one better, so badly did he want an opportunity to construct a new dam. Should the Bureau, instead of the Corps, be allowed to build Marysville Dam, he wrote Dominey, I restated our offer to make water from Marysville available to the state on an interim basis at a price no greater than under a Title III arrangement with the Corps. Then he added a cryptic, furtive remark. It was concluded that it would not be necessary to include this possibility in the state's comments. And no wonder. What Pafford was proposing was, if not illegal, then at the ragged margin of the law. Where did the Reclamation Act permit the Bureau to sell deeply subsidized water to a state on an interim basis, when the state would turn right around and resell it to some of the largest corporate farmers in the world? Where did it allow the Bureau to promise to match any price offered by the Corps before it even knew what the cost of developing the water would be? The answer was, nowhere. But the Bureau was willing to sell subsidized water from one of its dams to California, which would turn around and resell it at bargain surplus rates to 30,000 and 40,000 acre farmers who had the economic muscle to drive the Bureau's chief clients and dependents, the state's smaller farmers, out of business. And it was willing to do this, to play with federal law and forsake its small farmer constituency, simply because its arch-rival might snatch away a dam site it wanted for itself. 19 years later, Robert Pafford, then retired, never saw a bit of irony in this position. During an interview in 1983, he downplayed the rivalry between the Bureau and the Corps. We had our points of contention, but it was nothing serious. And said that he didn't blame Bill Warren for playing both ends against the middle. After all, he said, you might have done the same thing yourself. Warren, whom he referred to as a great guy, had a legal obligation to deliver water to his own constituency. Those contracts with the San Joaquin farmers were valid contracts, and he couldn't just ignore them. But why would the Bureau go out of its way to help a group of giant corporate farmers who might put the Bureau's little farmers out of business? Our farmers had water at $3.50 an acre-foot. No way anyone is going to compete with that. Involuntarily, Pafford admitted what the Bureau has always tried to deny, that its cheap water gives its client farmers an unfair advantage over all the other farmers of the nation. 2 years after the secret 1965 meeting, however, no agreement had been reached on Marysville Dam. Evidently, neither federal party would yield. Floyd Dominey, a proud man, privately loathed the Corps of Engineers and probably refused to go along with Pafford's recommendation, and each had the power to hang the project up in Congress, which appropriated no money for construction by anyone. By 1966, in fact, Pat Brown and Bill Warren evidently realized that their strategy of pitting the Bureau against the Corps could backfire on them. If the agencies became